Hello, and welcome to the Scott Mize Show, a podcast focused on health, diet, bodybuilding, and philosophy. I interview experts, doctors, coaches, and N equals one case studies to answer your questions about improving health, achieving your best physique, and making sustainable progress. We'll cover topics from carnivore and ketogenic diets, to bodybuilding, to life philosophy, and everything in between. Enjoy the show. This episode is brought to you by Element Electrolytes. This month, we're switching it up with an exclusive offer that's only for VIP Element partners, including CarnivoreCast listeners. You can now receive this free sample pack, along with any regular purchase, when you use my custom link, which is provided in the show notes or my Instagram link in bio. That's drinklmnt.com/CarnivoreCast, all one word. And as I said, I'll include the link in the show notes. Element Electrolytes are convenient, evidence-based, and delicious. And get yours today to help support the show. Thank you.
This is a quick disclaimer before we start the show. This show is for entertainment purposes only. Nothing said here should be taken as medical advice. And please consult with your physician before making any changes to your diet, exercise regime, or medications. Thank you, and on to the show. Paul Barnett, at Paul K. Barnett on Instagram, is a roughly 260-pound master's bodybuilding competitor at the ripe age of 50. He's made a commitment to transforming his dad bod into a champion bodybuilder through his system for accelerating fast fat loss, maximizing muscle gain, and hacking hormone optimization, carb cycling, and high-volume training. He's the host of the Anabolic Bodybuilding YouTube channel, featuring excellent deep dives on training, diet, and pharmacology, contest prep vlogs, interviews with experts in bodybuilding, and awesome Saturday or Sunday lives with excellent guests. And finally, he's the co-author of the Anabolic E-Course with pharmacology expert and former guest, Kurt Havens. Welcome to the show, Paul.
How's it going, man? I'm just a gym bro that loves bodybuilding. You could just sum it up in that.
Yeah. Well, you're very humble and very smart. And it's really inspiring to see, as someone who doesn't do this as their main career, to see how much time and commitment and how much excellent work you've put out sort of as a side gig with your YouTube channel. It's really cool to watch.
Yeah, it's a passion project. I like, you know, I talk about bodybuilding all the time. I'm sure my wife gets tired of me talking about it. So I figured why not just record it?
Smart. Yeah.
That's really what it boiled down to. So I'm constantly talking bodybuilding. People seem to like to hear me talk for some reason. Yeah. So
absolutely. And so taking it way back, when did you start bodybuilding the first time? What brought you into it?
Oh God, as a teenager, I didn't know what the hell I was doing. I remember seeing Arnold Schwarzenegger, I'm going to date myself, in Predator. And I remember going to see Predator, and there's that famous scene where he does the flex bicep with, the guy's name escapes me. He just passed away. Carl Weathers. And I'm like, I want to look like those guys. I remember just being obsessed with it. And I picked up Arnold's Encyclopedia of Bodybuilding, and I read it from cover to cover multiple times. There was so much bad information in it. Things have evolved a lot since then. But that was sort of my start. And then I just had some weights at home and started banging around with weights. And I got a gym membership when I was in high school and started working out at a gym where there was some pretty rough power lifters. And I kind of started off with those guys. Things were a lot different back then, but that was sort of the beginning of my journey. Late 80s, early 90s, I guess I got started and had no clue what I was doing. I was a skinny kid, played basketball. I think it was 170 pounds when I graduated high school, something like that.
Wow. And what made you stop bodybuilding? Like how long were you doing it? Did you compete? And then why'd you stop?
I was pretty consistently lifting. I was a gym bodybuilder. I had a couple false starts with shows in my 20s, but never really did it. But I guess I was a power builder. I got into sort of quasi powerlifting / bodybuilding. And I lifted pretty consistently from the time I was 16 until 32. And I managed to work my way from the 170 pounds up to about 300 at one point.
Wow.
It was not a pretty 300, but it's more of a strongman powerlifting 300.
But you
worked with, yeah, I made it. I made it. I worked with Dante Trudell. I don't know if you're familiar with him, DC training. Back when Dante used to train people, and Dante helped me put on the initial amount of size. So if you know anything about Dante's training, it's sort of power building style training.
Yep.
Progressive overload. I think he's modified some of his philosophies over the years, but that was how I started. I was just a gym bro, just wanted to look big in a t-shirt. And I had a couple false starts with contest prep. I just don't think I had the discipline required in my 20s to make it through a contest prep. And I got married, had kids, started a business, all this other stuff that happened that just kind of got in the way of it. And I took a almost a 12-year break, 10, 12 years. I think from 32 to 44, I stayed out of the gym pretty much completely. I would lift here and there. I did other things, played basketball, played rec basketball, did some jujitsu. I got into jujitsu for a while. I was always sort of active, but I kind of got pudgy there for a period of time, lost all the muscle. And then I went through a divorce at 44 and decided it's time to get back into the gym. And one of my short-term goals was to do a bodybuilding show. I had no illusions of actually getting on a national stage, but I just, you know, things kind of progressed and went well. And I was like, huh, I got bitten by the bug again. Let's see what we can do with this.
Yeah. That's really cool. And how much of your leaving bodybuilding was, did you, for the first time, did you feel like was your decision versus your ex-wife or your
it was
kids
just sort
or
of
just
an,
life?
It was just sort of an organic thing that happened.
Okay.
It's like, I started training less. I started not following a diet. I don't think anybody just wakes up one morning and says, I'm not doing this anymore.
Yeah.
It just, you know, you get home from a long day at work and you got young kids and a wife, and it's just like, damn, I don't feel like going to the gym tonight. I don't feel like meal prepping. And it just sort of progresses, and then you just get out of the habit. It's just, you slip back into bad habits. I wish I hadn't stopped. I feel like I could have gotten a pro card when I was younger, and probably, maybe I'm overestimating my abilities, but I feel like I could have done fairly well.
Yeah, I bet.
At it. I don't know if I could have been, you know, like the top of the sport, but I think I could have gotten a pro card and competed. I definitely think that was within the realm of possibility.
Yeah.
But you
know, you have a really unique perspective to bring to it.
Yeah. And I worked as a trainer too when I was younger. So it's not like I spent 4 years working in a gym as a trainer. I used to do some training, and I've helped people out here locally. I've always, you know, mainly focused on nutrition, and I sort of had an obsession with PEDs for a while, and, you know, learned a lot about PEDs, you know, the cool sciencey stuff. And then I found there are other science nerds on the internet. When I was younger, you couldn't find other people that would go, I mean, message boards on the internet, but there wasn't this group of people that you could commiserate with.
Yeah. Right. And what did you find was different when you came back to bodybuilding the second time in terms of like what worked for your body, what didn't, what you had to change about your approach?
Oh, everything was different. I'm an old man. That I got back in and I went back to that power building, progressive overload, train to failure, you know, balls to the wall, Dorian Yates style of training, whatever you want to call it, HIIT training. And I found out real quick that a 44-year-old body is not made to do that shit. And it was kind of disappointing, to be honest with you, because I love training that way. I love going into the gym and leaving nothing on the floor, coming out of the gym feeling like I just fought a battle that was a life and death battle, that I barely survived the workout. That was my way of training when I was in my 20s. And I found out real quick that you can't do that when you're in your 40s. So I had to sort of reinvent my style of training. I was disappointed because there was so much identity wrapped up in that style of training. And I think that's why people often get inflexible with things associated with bodybuilding when it comes to training. when it comes to diet, when it comes to PEDs, they almost fall in love or treat a certain style as religion or as, you know, they identify with it.
Yeah.
And I can understand that because I identified with that hardcore style of training. It made me feel a certain way. It was, you know, you feel like a badass when you do things that nobody else can do, when you're lifting weights that nobody else can lift. And it's sort of tough to take a step back and realize that you can't do that anymore.
Yep.
And I think that's why you see a lot of bodybuilders that end up just retiring early. Mm-hmm. You'll see a lot of guys, you'll see guys that make it into their 50s, and you'll see guys that quit when they're in their 30s. And I think a lot of times when they get in, you keep training that way, and then you end up getting hurt. It's not to say that you shouldn't train that way. I think there are many different paths to the goal line, but I feel like as you progress as a bodybuilder, you sort of need to rethink how your training approach is structured and how your diet is structured to fit where you're at a certain time. So there's a big difference. I mean, you're still a fairly young guy, but how old are you now, Scott?
I'm 31.
31. Okay, so you're at that age where you start to notice some things. Yeah. You can't go out at 31 and drink a bottle of tequila and party like you could when you were 21 in college, right? And wake up the next day and go to the gym and have a productive workout. Your body just can't recover from that.
Right.
And it progressively gets worse as you get older. So you have to consider fatigue. You have to consider how your body's going to respond to certain things and get better at managing that. And I think that was the biggest thing for me that changed. I couldn't eat food like I could when I was younger. Like my stomach would let me know if I overdid it with the food. I couldn't train with the same sort of intensity that I did when I was younger. My body would push back on me. I would have muscle tears, joint and connective tissue problems. I couldn't use the same, you know, you can't be hammering Anadrol and D-ball and train all day long like you could when you were in your 20s. So these things that worked when I was in my 20s did not work. And a lot of times guys, I think, will keep trying to jam that round peg into the square hole, and then they just give up when they can't.
Yeah.
I'm a critical thinker. I have a degree in computer science, so I'm always trying to think of ways to work around these limitations. And I sort of took a step back and sought out better ways to do things, things that my body could tolerate and handle. And I figured, what the fuck? Let's see what happens and change up my training style. I found Mike Israetel and really gravitated towards his style of training, keeping a little bit in the tank, providing enough stimulus for growth, but not so much that you can't recover. I simplified my diet and tried to stick with very easy to digest foods. Went on a low FODMAP diet. I stuck with PEDs that are safer and well tolerated. If I'm going to run something that's more toxic, it's very limited dose for short durations, only for specific needs. My PED philosophy now is, why take something that's toxic if there's a safer option that I can use as an alternative? So for example, do I really need to run Tren year round? No. Do I really need to take Anadrol in the off season, or could I just run a little bit more testosterone and get the same result? So things like that, just trying to critically think about things and adapt my training to where my body is at. And to my surprise, I made the best progress of my life in my mid-40s. That was the crazy thing.
Wow.
Yeah, that was the thing that really kind of threw me off, and I think threw some other people off. And I don't really think many guys my age have ever thought about this. There's just this assumption that you can't make progress once you hit 40.
Yeah.
And that's not true. I've proven that that's not true. And I've proven it with my clients many times that it's not true. And but you have to put your ego aside and think critically about stuff and maybe give up some things that you were doing when you were younger.
Yeah. Yeah. You're certainly evidence of that. It's incredible to see transformation you've made over the last few years. Definitely would encourage folks to check out Paul's Instagram for that. And it's funny when you're talking about people attaching themselves to training styles and identifying with them. I heard Dr. Mike Israetel, he's done a lot of good podcasts talking about like
why people are obsessed with training to failure, why people think it works. And he's very balanced generally in how he speaks about it. Because he's a very smart and academic guy. And one way I heard him talk about it was people use training to failure as like numbing an emotional pain almost.
Therapy.
Yeah, it's therapy, exactly. And then when you try to tell them that, because they're so obsessed with bodybuilding and getting the best results, when you try to tell them that the thing that they're doing that helps them mentally may not be the best thing for their physique, there's a huge amount of cognitive dissonance there. And they get really upset and defensive, and they look for evidence to the contrary.
Yeah, I mean, there's an emotional attachment to the feeling that you get from it. So it's really hard to detach yourself from that. That's one thing I've always tried. And I think I learned through my computer science background is that there's data and then there's feelings, really.
Yeah.
And you need to separate those two. And being intellectually flexible, not being, it's okay to say I was wrong and to change your mind about things. The things that I look back, I was pretty, you know, I used to be a model on some message boards and stuff 20 years ago. And I look back at some of the old posts and advice that I would give people, and it's none of it lines up with that now, like probably 75% of it. And some people would see that as a weakness. I see it as a strength to be able to reevaluate things, to progress how you feel. And that's not to say that maybe those things were right at the time of my life. Maybe they were. That it was the correct way to train and I just need to modify it. But yeah, Mike has a very, I think, very pragmatic approach to things. Like he was the first person I ever heard mention the cost of an exercise. Like I had never really considered that before. The fatigue cost, the stimulus ratio of stimulus to fatigue ratio of that exercise, the damage that exercise may do to connective tissue or joints. So for example, and I'm not trying to shit all over squats, but squats have a very, very, very high fatigue demand, axial fatigue, and squats put a lot of stress on your back. Squats are very rough on your hips. So, you know, I understand that it's necessary for powerlifting, but if you really take a critical look at it, would you be better off maybe doing something where your back is braced and you're placing more load on the actual muscle that you're trying to target? So something like maybe hack squats instead of barbell squats, maybe that is a better return on investment. The fatigue cost isn't as high. The stimulus, the fatigue cost is lower and the stimulus is higher. Maybe that would be a better option. And I'd never considered that before. For me, it was just whatever hurts the most is probably the best. Whatever makes me feel like I need to puke in a trash can is probably the best. I never really set my feelings aside and thought about what that part of the equation was. And that was really sort of an eye opener for me. And I went back through and reevaluated all my exercise choices. You know, for example, skull crushers are something I used to be in love with for triceps, but my elbows were in constant pain doing skull crushers. I never really, and I think most guys don't take the time to consider this, thought about, God damn, is it really worth doing skull crushers and destroying my elbows? Am I really getting that much of a benefit out of it to have that sort of damage and soreness and cost of that exercise? So you really have to think about the return on investment of your exercise choices. It's the same with food. It's the same with PEDs as well. I really sort of opened my mind up to really take a step back and evaluate all those areas. What is going to give me the highest return on investment for cost? It's the same thing with PEDs. There is a cost to taking every PED. You know, you and I were talking about it before we started recording with, something like Tren causing stress to your body, you know, upset stomach and lack of sleep, fatigue, or same thing with orals, you know, orals causing you to feel, you know, crushing your appetite, destroying your stomach, making you feel sick, is that really worth the benefit that you're getting from it? Or would there be a better choice, a better cost to investment rate, cost to benefit ratio of your choices? And I really looked at that for everything that I was doing in my life. What is the cost of this? What is the benefit? And I want the choice to be the one with the lowest cost and the highest benefit with everything I do.
Yeah. It's very smart, because so much of what we do compiles stress and compiles health toll on us.
Yeah. There's this weird thing in bodybuilding where guys think that if it hurts more, if it makes me feel worse, that it must be better.
Yeah.
Right. Which sometimes is true, but not always. And I think it's important to take a critical step back and think about that. And I think that was an area that I probably wouldn't have been in a place mentally to do when I was in my 20s. I wouldn't have thought about it like that. It took getting my ass kicked and having some injuries, having surgeries, just life beating me up a little bit to think like that. And that's sort of my thing that I hope to share with younger bodybuilders, is consider the cost of what you're doing. There is a time to push the gas pedal down. That is for sure. But you have to be calculated with it.
Yeah. With regards to the training, do you have clients who train this way, the higher volume, not to failure, versus low volume, high intensity?
Yeah, I do have clients. You've worked with me before. I don't get too married to one training philosophy. Training seems to be a very personal thing for people.
Sure.
And I know this is sort of a controversial take, but for me, the pyramid of success in bodybuilding is hormone optimization, nutrition, training, and then rest and recovery. And I think, honestly, training is probably at the bottom of that pyramid. And that's going to be a controversial take. And I'll tell you why, because I've seen plenty of dudes that go into the gym and train their asses off and still look like shit.
Oh, the top of the pyramid, you mean? Right.
Yeah.
The least
important. Yeah. Sorry. The base. Yeah, I have it in reverse. And so for me, nutrition, hormone optimization are sort of at the base. If you don't have, I had that backwards. It's sort of the Maslow's hierarchy of needs for bodybuilding.
Yeah.
So for me, nutrition is at the bottom of that period. I've seen plenty of dudes that take tons of steroids and train hard that look like shit or have not progressed. And I've witnessed it with clients. I get people to get their diet cleaned up, get them pointed in the right direction, and then suddenly they start making progress and looking differently. So I don't get too, circling back around here, I don't get too focused in on the training. I think with me, for the training, while it is important, I'm not saying it's not important, you do need to provide adequate stimulus. I think that you need to provide the stimulus, the appropriate stimulus to progress. You need to select the right exercises to grow a physique in a balanced way. Your form needs to be clean enough to that you're actually stimulating the muscle that you're trying to target. And you need to choose exercises that you can recover from that are not destroying your body. So I think if you just kind of hit those fundamentals, really how your split is, what exercise choices you're making, how often you're trained is really sort of subjective and not as important. That's sort of the way I look at it. I do think there is an optimal way to train for bodybuilding, but everybody has different goals. So, I mean, if you want to go to the gym and be strong and big, you would train a little bit different than what you would for bodybuilding. I don't really give a fuck how much weight I'm lifting. Okay. I mean, I've never heard a judge ask somebody how much they bench press. Right? Yeah. They don't care. That's sort of my take on training. I do think training progresses and gets different as you age and become an advanced bodybuilder. I do think for a beginner that progressive overload, building a strength base, learning how to do the exercises correctly in a productive manner for hypertrophy is important. But I think as you get more advanced, that maybe things such as progressive overload isn't as important. Like at this point, you know, I'm, 260, 270 pounds, I'm 50 years old. How much more am I going to progress the weights?
Yeah.
Right. I mean, if you're inclined pressing 405, where are you going to go?
Yeah.
Right. Yeah. So, I mean, there's only so far you can progress the weights. So I think then you have to look at other modalities of progressing. You know, maybe it's volume, maybe it's upping the rep ranges, maybe it's cleaning your form up and doing things that may place more tension on the muscle, things like that. So, you know, that's sort of my take on training. It's a bit subjective. I think stuff that's a little bit more set in stone is the diet and the PEDs.
Yeah. You know, I think it's really interesting. I think you've managed to start to convince Justin Harris, a hardcore DC guy, of the benefits of higher volume training too. I've heard him talk about on recent podcasts. He's like, you know, I really wish I had tried higher volume for my arms. I think they would have responded a lot better. And then Justin, he cites you actually and your success.
Justin and I have talked about it. He's just like, I can't wrap my head around the way you train. It's like, as much as it makes sense. And then, once again, I think Justin's background, he was a strength athlete.
Yeah.
You know, he came from a strength background. He came from that DC background. And he's a few years younger than me. I don't know. Justin's probably 44, 45, something like that. And you just come to that realization that you can't keep doing that anymore. I think he tore his bicep recently. It's just your body just can't keep doing that. There is a point in time where you can't. Like, it's like, this is what I tell guys. Would you go play a tackle football game at 45 years old with your friends at a backyard barbecue like you would?
No.
When you were 22? No, you're not going to be doing that, right? So why in the world would you train the way you did when you were 22? Your body just can't handle that sort of stress anymore, even with the PEDs.
Yeah. You'll see it.
I see it all the time. Like, I'll see these dudes that continue to push through, but then they just start getting hurt. They tear muscles. They tear ligaments. They rip their pecs off the bone. And they wear it as a badge of honor. And I'm like, no, dude, that's dumb. You don't want to get hurt.
Yeah. I think it's very also like interesting. It's very rare you hear people say training is the least important because it doesn't seem as tough and as hardcore as saying, you know, oh, the drugs don't really matter. Everyone's taking drugs. The drugs are just, you know, enhancements. You know, diet is important, but it's really the training that builds physiques. So it's interesting. Like, it's all important, of course, but it's interesting.
Yeah, it's all part of the equation.
Yeah.
But you can take a look at it. I mean, like, once again, this is thinking about things critically. And I'm not discounting training. I don't want people to think that you don't need to train. You do need to train with sufficient intensity in a proper way to elicit a response. But if you think about it, and this is why I say it's the least important. And it's, once again, I go back to this. You go into every gym in America, every bro gym, you see it at your gym. You see guys, a lot of guys training hard that look like shit.
Yeah.
And half of them are on PEDs.
Yeah. Yeah. Oh yeah. Definitely.
Right. And so you know this. The way to change your body in the quickest fashion possible is not changing your training program, it's changing your diet. You know, so for me, that's for bodybuilding, that's at the base of the pyramid. Now, for something like powerlifting, maybe training is the most important part of it. Mm-hmm. It's a different sport though. For bodybuilding, we're trying to look good on the stage. So, but it's, you know, it's all a piece of the puzzle. But for me, the nutrition is the largest piece of the puzzle. And then I probably would put PEDs right behind that.
Yeah. Yeah.
For bodybuilding.
It's interesting. You know, I'm in prep now. I have a show in a week and I've been watching a ton of old training videos from like the 90s of Dexter Jackson and John De La Rosa, Kevin Lavroni, Jay Cutler, Phil Heath. And they all trained pretty much the same way, which was they'd pick an exercise and they'd do like 5 sets.
Mm-hmm.
And they wouldn't treat warm-ups any differently than working sets. Yeah. So they wouldn't do this thing where you're doing, you know, 10 reps, then five, then three, then one on your warmups, it would be like 12, 12, 12, 12, 12. Yep. So like 12 with one plate, 12 with two plates, 12 with three plates, 12 with four plates. And then maybe the last set would be like kind of hard, but still not to failure. And then they'd move on to the next exercise. And you're like squinting. You're like, did the rep even slow down? Like, you know, they grimace a little bit. Maybe they yell, but it's like, and they all did that. And all of those guys, as far as I know, suffered pretty minimal injuries and grew a ton in the years they were competing in their off seasons. And they're not doing anything close to this, like top set back off, super low volume approach with like, you know, 10 minutes rest between sets that all these people are advocating now. So I just find it really interesting.
It's funny how it's come full circle, because in the early 90s, when Dorian was successful, hit gained popularity, and then it just sort of faded into obscurity. And Dorian, I don't want to take anything away from him. He's my favorite bodybuilder of all time. And I used to train like that. But you can look at it. Because my background is in computer science and data analytics, there in statistics, you can look at thing. Somebody like Dorian is an outlier. He is the only person that has been at the top of the Olympia stage training like that. And that was something I talked about with Mike Israetel, and he talked about the survivorship bias. And people tend to have a bias towards the one person that did something that is outside the norm and had success with it, rather than looking at, you might have one person out of 100 that succeeded and 99 others that failed. The 99 that failed are actually more important to look at than the one person that succeeded. Yeah,
absolutely.
That one person that succeeded, he just may have gotten lucky.
Yeah, fell through the cracks.
Right. You know, so like with Dorian, you can ultimately see, he had to retire when he was, what, 35, 36?
Yeah.
Something like that, because of injuries. And you can see it. The guys that don't last are the ones that train super heavy to failure. And there are some people that get by without it. I mean, I think Ronnie Coleman lasted into his 40s, but he's in a wheelchair now. And people like to say, well, it was from a football injury or whatever. That's not how injuries work. It's cumulative damage over time that adds up and ends up causing problems. And it's not to take anything away from it. If you told me I had to be in a wheelchair when I was 55 and I would get 5 Olympia titles, I might sign up for that. Maybe. Yeah. I don't know.
I think a lot of people would.
Right. So, but it's just people like to look at the outliers. It's the same thing with nutrition. They like to look at that one guy that can eat cheeseburgers and drink milkshakes and get ripped.
Yeah.
That guy is the exception. He is not the norm. So if we were going to model our training, our PED protocols for the most success, wouldn't you want to work from the mean first, the middle ground first? And then if you are an outlier, then you can sort of work your way out to that.
Yeah.
So why would you start off training like the one guy that had success versus the 99 that did?
Yeah.
So you're right. Pretty much every freaking bodybuilder, if you look at it, they do a bro split or they do a PPL. And they train with some sort of moderate to higher volume, and very few of them actually train to absolute failure, even still.
Yeah. Yeah. And it works.
They don't train like powerlifters. They don't train like CrossFitters.
And they don't get injured, and they take the right drugs and they eat the right food.
Yeah. And you know, they all eat meat and rice. They all, you know, take test GH, either Equipoise or Primobolan in the off season. They all run the same shit on contest prep. It's just the weights, the food, and the drugs go up as you get bigger.
Yeah.
I mean, it's really, that's the formula.
What's been, Paul, your preferred approach to diet and what you find works for most clients?
Diet is another area where people get completely locked in and they treat it like religion. You know, I'm team keto. I'm team carnivore. I'm team vegan, whatever it may be. That drives me absolutely insane. If you become locked in, treat diet or anything you do like dogma or religion, you're not going to you're not going to have the best success. I look at nutrition as a tool in the toolbox, and there are different tools for different jobs. I personally am running a carb cycling diet for which is essentially calorie cycling for bodybuilding. And if you look at most bodybuilding coaches now, they're running some version of carbs, calorie cycling. They're doing refeed. You may call it a high day. You may call it a refeed day, whatever the hell you want to do it. They're stacking more carbs around workouts than they are on days where you're not working out. It's essentially the same shit. For somebody that is severely obese and maybe insulin resistant that needs to lose weight, maybe a keto style diet makes sense for them. Right. So it's, you know, I am not inflexible when it comes to that. I do think for bodybuilding, I've seen the best results from some sort of caloric cycling, whether that's strict carb cycling or, you know, whether you do some sort of refeed day once a week. But that seems to be the best for body composition. A higher carbohydrate diets seem to work best for bodybuilders. And then it makes sense when you think about it, because muscle contractions are a glycolytic process. You have, you know, a big bodybuilder can store up to 1,000 grams of carbs or more in glycogen. So why wouldn't you want the optimal fuel for muscle contractions? Plus it makes you look fuller. So you can look at the science on it. The science shows that low carbohydrate diets are not the greatest things for bodybuilding success. Now you're going to need to be lower carb when you're cutting, right? Carbs are the wild card. There are no essential carbs. So carbs are your wild card when you're trying to drop calories to lose weight.
Yep.
I do think thermodynamics rules supreme. There are a lot of people that want to argue and say that it doesn't, but at the end of the day, it is calories in, calories out. Macro choices do matter because your body does store and use that energy differently. It's not that thermodynamics is violated. I mean, you can take a step back and look at it. Carbs can be stored as, preferentially, they are stored as glycogen first, and then adipose, fat tissue second. Fat, anything that you eat in excess of fat, is just going to be stored as, it's already prepackaged and ready to be stored as fat. So one would reason that you want to keep your fats moderate or lower if you want an ideal body composition. And then protein is used for tissue repair and growth. The process that your body has to go through to convert protein into body fat is pretty complex and damn near impossible. I'm not saying that you can't store fat protein as body fat, but it is possible. So you would think that our diets need to be primarily based around protein, carbohydrates as fuel, and then you want enough fats to for essential fatty acids. You want enough fats for cellular repair, vitamin transport. But you want to keep things like saturated fats and stuff minimum. That's sort of my philosophy on it, especially considering that most people are taking PEDs that are already going to skew lipids. So running a higher fat diet is probably not smart if you value not having an arterial blockage at some point in your life.
Yeah. What you mentioned a few times, Tess, Primo, GH, what are those the compounds you think are most effective? And what do you think are some really overrated compounds today?
Those are the ones that I have found what worked best for me. And it's funny, I've talked to a lot of pro bodybuilders. I think I've looked at your list of podcasts. It seems like you've talked to a lot of guys, but it seems like everybody eventually, they all start off trying everything, and everybody ends up eventually settling on the same shit in the end.
Yeah.
It's the same thing with the diet. It's the same thing with the training. Everybody ultimately comes to the same conclusion because there is one optimal way to do things. For the off season, I think for growth phases, I think running the dose probably matters more than compound choice is what I've seen. So considering that milligrams matter more than compounds, and this is just anecdotal, considering that, I would want to choose the things that my body tolerates the best. And we look at the hormones that are bioidentical, the hormones that our bodies already make. We know what the pathways of reduction are for them to other hormones in our body, how they're going to act in our body, you probably want to stick with those as the base of everything you're using. So we're talking about testosterone. We know how our bodies are going to handle testosterone. We know how our bodies are going to handle growth hormone. We know how our bodies are going to handle insulin. And then you would want to layer that with whatever anabolic you tolerate the best. And it seems like most guys, most pros, end up either using Equipoise or Primobolan as their primary anabolic. At least that's what I've seen. There's a popular craze now for people running Masteron as their primary anabolic in the off season, which is fine if that's what you want to do. But I think if you get the doses high enough, it doesn't matter. I mean, if you're running 3 grams of test of Masteron, I mean, you're going to grow.
Yeah. It seems like the only people who say, at least most of the time, the only people who say Equipoise over Primobolan are people who don't trust Primobolan, to be real.
Yeah, I found that, I mean, you can, I don't know how much faith you can put in it, but there was a study, I don't know, it was done 40, 50 years ago. It was a rat study, but it showed that really the rates of protein synthesis between all the different compounds wasn't that much different. It was really what mattered was dose. Now, there are other things. There's genomic and non-genomic factors that play into how your body reacts to those. I mean, when you look at it, you know, Anadrol seems to have no effect, genomic effect at all, but we all know from taking Anadrol that it works, right?
Yeah.
Right. So that's a thing to consider. Like on paper, Tren would probably be the best, right? But we know from taking it, it's not. It has its place. So it's constructing the off season. I want to run the safest compounds, the most well-tolerated compounds. I generally stay away from orals. Orals seem to have all the negative side effects and no really additional benefit in the off season, except for maybe if you're a strength athlete. Mm-hmm. If you're peaking for, if you think about it, they're really just for peaking for whatever event you're going into. If you're a strength athlete, such as a power lifter, something like Anadrol is going to drive more, it's going to have more neural drive and cause you to be stronger temporarily. So there is a compelling reason to use it for competition. Going into a bodybuilding show, something like Anavar or Winstrol seem to have an effect on body composition that you can't achieve with other things. So there is a compelling reason to use them at that time. But in the off season, there really isn't. So why would you put your body through extra toxicity if you're feeling sick, if your stomach's upset, and you can't eat, you're not going to grow. So it would probably make more sense to lean into things that are going to be more well-tolerated for the majority of the year and save those harsher compounds for when you need them, when their unique benefits would be of an advantage for you, such as going into peaking for a powerlifting meet or a bodybuilding show.
Yep. What do you think about the old adage of time on equals time off?
I think it's horseshit. I don't know where it came from. I think somebody just made that up.
Yeah.
I mean, really, there's no logic behind it at all.
Yeah. How do you think about time off for yourself and for clients? And maybe we should define what off means too.
Yeah. I mean, there is a point, and I'm sure you've been there before, where you in an off season. I was just talking with one of my friends yesterday. He's like, I'm just not feeling good.
Yeah.
I'm feeling lethargic. I'm not growing anymore. There is a point where you hit the wall. And when you hit the wall, maybe it is good to pull down from the super physiological levels back down to just sort of a maintenance, whatever that is for your given point in the journey, TRT for some people, and just give your body a break and let it breathe. Because we are mashing the gas pedal down. It is like driving your car with the gas pedal all the way down to the floor. It's only so long you can redline the engine before something starts to give. And there is an argument to be made, and I've heard people say this, that why not just run moderate doses? Some of the safer use people I hear out of there, why not just run moderate doses year round? And maybe the net gain would be better long term. I just haven't seen that in practicality. I've seen that if you want to bust past plateaus, sometimes you have to push. That's just what I've seen, and then back off. It may not be the best. Maybe the other way of just running moderate doses all year round would be safer in the long term, possibly. I don't know, but but once again, this is a sport where we're trying to push things to the limit.
Yeah.
And I just haven't seen that in practicality. And I don't know of anybody that's a top level bodybuilder that does it that way. Yeah. Now there is a time to back off and let your body breathe. I was down to TRT, what I consider TRT, 250 milligrams a test for about 4 months after my show. I just backed off. I was pretty much on for almost a year straight.
Yeah.
So, and just let my body breathe.
Unless you're Dr. Todd, then.
Dr. Todd hasn't had a cruise in 15 years.
Jesus.
Something like that. But he also doesn't, he runs fairly mild compounds, and he doesn't run super high doses either. What I would consider not super high. Some people probably would.
I wanted to talk a bit about rebounds. And you've had the mother of all rebounds after some of your recent shows.
Yeah.
Putting on how much muscle?
Jumped my stage weight from 1 year to the next by 40 pounds. Yeah.
Crazy. How did you and Justin structure that? What's worked well for you, and what has also worked for clients?
I've seen it work with about 75% of my clients. Some people it doesn't work for, just being transparent with you. I think you have to sort of see how your body responds. The philosophy is, at the end of prep, you're insulin sensitivity is going to be the highest that it's probably going to be all year round. One would assume, and I don't know, I have any evidence of this. This is just an assumption that myostatin is going to be low because you've been in a calorie deficit for an extended period of time. Gastric emptying is going to be at an all-time high because you've had restricted eating. Your body's going to be able to process food. And you're going to be glycogen depleted. So it's like all of these factors line up to set up a situation where there seems to be some sort of super compensation that happens with some people after a show. And I think the caveat here is that you have to be super depleted. You have to be very lean. Like I would say like 5% body fat lean, like where you're at right now is what I'm talking about. Mm-hmm. You can't get to 10% body fat and expect to have a huge rebound. It doesn't work that way. I've had some people that have been disappointed. You also have to have the discipline post show to keep your shit together and not go ape shit and bury your face in pizza and ice cream for weeks straight afterwards. And my thought process is, hunger is going to be out of control after a show. So this whole notion of reverse dieting generally doesn't work. And I get the philosophy behind it that you want to sort of reverse out of a show gently. But I don't think it works because people are just going to end up binge eating and having that pizza, having that ice cream, and they're going to have a horrible fat rebound after a show. And top that, usually the sort of the old school way of doing things that I would see coaches do was just have everybody come off everything cold turkey. For sure. So not only are you eating like shit, you're in this hugely hormonally compromised state where you've dropped all your androgens, you dropped all of the aromatase inhibitors, you dropped all the fat burners. So your metabolism's going to be in the shitter. All the androgens are out of your body. And then you're likely going to have a huge estrogen rebound. So you've just set up this horrible situation to get fat. You're going to have hunger, high hunger, bad hormones, tanked metabolism. So to me, what makes more sense would be to drop the toxic compounds after the show, get rid of the orals, get rid of the trend, reduce your doses because you don't need as much anabolics when you're in a food surplus. So that eliminates the need for high doses of anabolics. You can cut your anabolics in half.
Yeah.
And then just fill up on good food. Go hard back to the paint, but eat good food. You're going to be hungry anyway, so you might as well fill up on meat and rice. You can have some cheat meals here and there. And then what I've seen is you've got this runway of about 6 to 8 weeks post-show if you do everything perfectly.
Yeah.
Where what'll happen is generally you'll get back up to your off-season weight, maybe even ahead of your off-season weight, but at a much, much lower body fat percentage. Mm. So you may have been, let's say you finished your previous off-season at 15% at 250 pounds. You might be able to get back up to 250 pounds at 10% body fat.
Right.
Yeah, and that's what I've seen happen. Now, there are some situations.
I hope I can do that.
Well, I mean, you've set yourself up for it. You just got to be smart with how you handle the rebound. There are some situations where I've seen people have huge water rebounds post-show, and you have to be more careful with the carbohydrates.
Yeah.
I've learned that. I also think sometimes people lie about what they eat post-show. They go out and just binge eat.
Yeah.
And then they have these huge water rebounds. You know, I've seen people gain 30, 40 pounds in a few days post-show. Wow. Which is crazy.
How many high days would you do post-show typically?
How Justin does it, and I do it a little bit different. Justin runs 5 consecutive high days post-show. He gives you one free day where you can just go eat whatever you want.
Yep.
I have not been doing that with people. I'll tell them to get a cheat meal post-show, go out and get breakfast the next morning, and then we're back on the diet.
Yeah.
And then usually what I'll do is run 3 consecutive high days.
Okay.
I'll have them check in with me, send me pics to make sure that they aren't having a huge water rebound.
And then we look for the next 6 weeks, how many high days are you doing?
2 to 3, depending on how they react. That's the problem with carbohydrates. Carbohydrates can cause water retention.
Yeah.
So you have to be really careful with sodium. I think that's what really where people get themselves in trouble post-show is they eat high fat, very salty foods that you know, they're going to eat desserts and shit. So you're going to eat cookies, cakes, hamburgers, french fries, things like that, that are very salty, yeah, high in fat, high in carbohydrates. And that's just setting yourself up for a massive water, yeah, rebound, especially if you use diuretics into a show, because your aldosterone is going to be all out of, there isn't an aldosterone rebound after you use a diuretic. Mm-hmm. So it is just something to consider. People end up with electrolyte imbalances post-show. So you have to keep an eye on that. That's why I have them check in with me. Usually, sometimes I'll have them check in with me every day post-show just to make sure. Yeah. But then you have that 6-week run where I'll run 2 to 3 high days a week, just depending on how their body responds. I try to get as aggressive with it as I possibly can without them having a bunch of water retention. If their ankles are starting to swell up, if they have things like that, then we'll pull back a little bit.
And then you finish the 6 weeks, run blood work, and then what? You keep pushing if they're healthy?
Go into a cruise usually at that point. 6 to 8 weeks. If I can extend it out to 8 weeks, we'll extend out to 8 weeks. And then usually I'll just go into a maintenance phase. I'll take another 6 to 8 weeks. Just give them a break. Come down to like TRT or just maybe like testosterone and just a small amount of like Masteron or something to keep them dry or to deal with estrogen. And then we'll probably pull the food back down to 1 high day a week and just kind of sit there and let our body settle in at the new weight before we go into an off season.
Yeah. Yeah. It's really interesting. So I've asked every guest recently about rebounds. Kurt obviously has a similar philosophy to you. You coach Kurt, yeah. And then, Justin Compton, also very similar philosophy.
Yeah, I know he does rebounds too.
But Chris Tuttle, and I've heard Austin Stout talk about it similarly, and John Jewett, their philosophy is immediately post-show, your body is set up to, just like you said, gain a lot of body fat. Even if you're really lean, you're really insulin sensitive, your body wants physiologically to get the body fat back. So the objective for them with their clients is get fat back on, get up to, you know, 20 pounds over stage weight, over you know, 4 to 6 weeks. And then, and in that time, beyond like a cruise dose, TRT plus, whatever you want to call it, be healthy. And then at that point, you're in a really good place where you're still pretty insulin sensitive. You got some body fat back on. Any weight that you would have gained, you know, blasting in the rebound in those first few weeks is probably mostly glycogen, water, a lot of fat. So just get healthy. And then once you've done that, then you can start like a 20-week off season there. So it's interesting to hear like the kind of different philosophy. I think at the end of the day, you end up in the same place. But yeah, that's kind of how they think about it.
Yeah, and I've heard that philosophy and I disagree with it.
Yeah.
I do think there are situations where you do need to back off. Like if you have somebody that's completely haggard, just done at the end of contest prep, you can tell from their body.
Yeah.
That may be the better approach.
Yeah.
And like I said, I in my experience, it works about 75% of the time and 25% of the time.
Yeah.
But I do think a lot of times that has to do with diet discipline post show. Yeah. I think a lot of times people stop training. I think a lot of times people stop doing the cardio. I think a lot of times people, you know, this is what I've talked about with Justin. You should get him on sometime to talk. You'll see it in the pros. Like most pros, they compete so much, they don't really have time for an off season.
Yeah.
So what they're doing really is essentially a rebound.
Yeah.
And it seems like when guys make their best progress is when they're constantly lean and competing. It seems like that's when they make their best progress. You know, and so my thought process is why not take advantage of that time period? And I disagree. I don't think it's temporary. And I think a lot of it has to do with how you structure your diet. If your diet sucks, you are going to have that huge fat rebound. But I have seen if you can keep people together, you don't. So, I mean, you think about it, how your body processes these foods. If you're eating a bunch of high sugar, high fat food post show, that is a recipe to add body fat. Your body is going to prioritize glucose as a fuel source at all times. So whatever excess fats you eat are likely just going to get stored as adipose. But if you can keep yourself fairly low fat, keep the carbs high, keep the protein high, I have not seen that rapid fat gain post show.
Yeah.
And I also think sometimes the rapid fat gain post show is because of hormonal crashes as well. So like pulling down to TRT, what happens, you know, and I've talked about this with Kurt, what happens is you've dropped your androgen load from here. Your estrogen was buried and then you pull out the AIs all of a sudden, your estrogen's going to come rocketing up. So that ratio of estrogen to testosterone gets really out of whack. And that sets you up hormonally for rapid fat gain on top of tanking the fat burners, you know, instead of tapering off of them and just pulling them right out. You also have this compromised situation where your metabolism just crashes. So it's the perfect storm for fat gain. So I think that's where the fat gain comes in.
Yep.
I think if you taper off things, I usually taper down the drug. So I'll just come, I'll taper off over that 6 to 8 week period into a cruise. Right. Yeah. And I've found that seems to work better.
Yeah. And I think we probably don't want to throw out numbers, but people would be surprised at how much you lower it too. In that phase, like you said, like kind of cut it in half.
Yeah. I'll tell you
kind of halfway between a cruise and a blast.
I mean, I'll tell you exactly what I did on that rebound that where I had a huge gain. I was running 500 tests, 300 MPP.
Yeah.
And just a little bit of GH.
Crazy.
I mean, it was nothing crazy. And I made huge progress.
Yeah.
During that time period. And then I tapered down into a 250 milligram test cruise.
Yeah.
You know, and I also disagree that you don't, you know, they say that you don't retain that. It's just not, I don't know what happens physiologically. I don't know if it is some sort of sarcoplasmic change or what it is, but I've seen people hang on to that. Like, I clearly acquired new size.
Yeah. Definitely.
You know, stage weights don't lie.
There's been so many, to your point, it's the way almost all the top guys do it. There's been so many coaches who've done it with so much success with lots of people. I think there has to be something to it. It's just interesting to hear the different philosophies.
Yeah. And I think probably why those guys get a little gun shy is because you've seen a ton of those dudes that just get rapidly fat post show.
Yeah.
And I understand wanting to exercise a little bit of extra caution. I totally get it.
Yeah.
And there are some people that are just like that, or it's just some people that just, they can't keep going. Like, I love training and eating post show. That feeling, like, you get 1 week post show and you've got some food back in you, you look fucking great. You feel great. Your strength starts to go up, man. That is my favorite time. The time that I don't want to train, the time that I hate training, is the end of off season when you're bloated, you're tired, you're just over it, man. Like, I'm just ready to go into prep. My favorite time of the year is that post-show rebound phase, man. Why not make the most of it?
Yeah, absolutely. Well, thank you so much for coming on, Paul. This has been awesome. Man. I learned so much from you, and I'm sure the audience will too. I'll have links to everything of yours in the show notes, but is there anywhere especially you want to point out for people?
They can just go to Instagram. I'm Paul K. Barnett on there. Anabolic Bodybuilding on YouTube. I am also on Twitter, although there's like nobody on Twitter, but I'm trying it.
It's funny you say that. All the people in fitness say there's nobody on Twitter. And then if you look in like any other field, nobody's on Instagram. It's like very polarizing. Like,
yeah, all the bodybuilders are on Instagram.
Yeah. Like, if you look at like gaming, for instance, like, I don't know, I follow some gamers on Twitch.
And I'm a gamer.
None of them are on Instagram. They're all on Twitter. All they do is Twitter. So it's just funny. Anyway, hope you have a great rest of your day, Paul. Thank you very much. All right.
Thank you, man.
Thank you for listening to the show. You can find the Scott Mize Show on Instagram, YouTube, Facebook, and Twitter. Please leave a comment, like, review, or share the podcast with your friends or followers. It helps more people find the show.